my rights away. The faster I will run, you can deny me, you can decide to turn your face away. No matter, 'cause there's something inside so strong. I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone, oh no. Something inside so strong, oh, something inside so strong. My voice, the louder I will sing. You hide behind walls of Jericho, your lies will come tumbling. Deny my place and time, you squander. Something inside so strong, so strong. I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone.
That's Labif Sifre with Something Inside So Strong, a song he wrote in 1985 about the brutality of apartheid in South Africa. He had seen a documentary in which there was a white soldier shooting at black children. Labif Sifre is based in London. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Thursday, February the 12th. And between the Civil War and World War II, thousands of African-American men, women, and children were victims of terror lynchings, says our guest, Brian Stevenson, founder and director of the Montgomery, Alabama-based Equal Justice Initiative, which has documented almost 4,000 such cases in 12 southern states. These barbaric and public acts of torture and terrorism, he says, were tools of white supremacy that created a fearful environment where racial subordination and segregation were maintained with limited resistance for decades. The Equal Justice Initiative just Tuesday released a comprehensive report titled Lynching in America, Confronting the Legacy of Racial Terror. And Mr. Stevenson, I'm so delighted that you will be with us today to discuss the report. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you.
Well, 4 years and thousands of hours spent researching. What were the major findings of your report?
Well, I think the first would be that this era is more accurately described as terrorism rather than random acts of mob violence. It's pretty clear from the historical record that the object of these lynchings wasn't really to punish people for perceived crimes. It was to really terrorize and traumatize people of color into being compliant with racial segregation and racial hierarchy. Many of the people who were lynched weren't even lynched for crimes that we recognized. It wasn't for just murder or rape. There were people who were lynched for wearing their World War I military uniform in a train station, which happened in Blakely, Georgia. An African-American man in Luverne, Alabama, was lynched because he didn't use the title Mr. when he addressed a police officer. There was a man lynched for bumping into a white woman as he ran to a train station. This violence was really the tool that people used to sustain this era of Jim Crow and segregation The other two findings that I think are interesting is that many of the lynchings are what we characterize as public spectacle lynchings, where the violence was actually attended by hundreds, sometimes thousands of people who would celebrate and picnic and watch these horrific, grotesque, barbarous acts of violence as if at a carnival or a show. The public spectacle lynchings are interesting because they implicated everyone in the community, not just some one or two masked perpetrators, but the entire community. And there were hundreds of these such lynchings that were sometimes advertised in local newspapers, etc. And then I think the other finding that's worth emphasizing is that it really does, in our judgment, confirm that the great migration that takes place between in the first half of the 20th century, especially between 1900 and 1930, where millions of African Americans fled the South to cities like Los Angeles, Oakland, Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, in the North and the East, was really triggered by terror. These were not people seeking economic opportunity. These were people who were fleeing terror as refugees and exiles. And that identity, I think, is important in understanding the subsequent history of African Americans who become ghettoized and marginalized in the urban North and far West, but still grateful for having a little more security than what they experienced in the terrorizing Deep South.
Well, you write in the introduction of the report that these public acts of torture traumatized black people throughout the country. And one wonders, why didn't they also traumatize whites?
It's interesting that we do talk about the impact, but you have to understand, I think, going back to slavery, there was a narrative of racial difference that was developed during the era of slavery that was influential even among people who were not slaveholders. To me, the great evil of slavery wasn't involuntary servitude. That was obviously horrific and demeaning and disempowering. But the true evil of slavery was this narrative of racial difference, this ideology that black people were not fully human, deficit, not as smart, not as hardworking. And as a result of that, there was this acceptance of victimizing black people, of mistreating black people, that didn't implicate your moral character. You could be a good Christian and a moral person, a nice person, and still own slaves because they weren't human beings. And our 13th Amendment didn't really deal with that narrative of racial difference. And in many ways, slavery didn't end. It just evolved. It turned into decades of supremacy and racial hierarchy. And so part of the indifference that many whites had to the victimization of people during the lynching era was rooted in their continued belief in the inferiority of African Americans. And, you know, it's almost the way we sometimes think about the mistreatment of animals, and it just doesn't trigger the same thing. And so it really did take the assertion of black humanity and success to kind of push back against that idea before the rest of the country would even acknowledge that this was barbarous, torturous misconduct of other human beings. As that evolved, you did see more voices rising up. In addition to the NAACP, the League of Women Voters began in the 1930s organizing against lynchings. And I think eventually there was a recognition that this kind of barbarism was absolutely undermining the quality of life for everyone in these counties. I think part of the reason that we haven't talked about this era as much as I think we should be is because it is difficult. Now there is pain in kind of reflecting and realizing the kind of violence and abuse that these acts represented. And so I do think it is traumatizing for the entire community, but if you never talk about it, if you don't know about it, you minimize that trauma. I don't think that's a healthy way forward. I think when you're dealing with these kinds of human rights violations, you've got to commit yourself to truth and reconciliation. Whether you're in South Africa or Rwanda, you've got to own up to these histories. And we haven't done that in this country, and I think there will be some discomfort, but I also think it's a necessary process for making racial progress.
By the time these acts, these barbaric acts, had come into full swing, pardon that pun. America had been through centuries, really, of just awful, awful violence against the First Nations that were here. Genocidal acts were committed. The First Nations were wiped out, subjected to unimaginable violence, and their people displaced from their land, and we know that story. The insistence, it seems, that we ought to get over it. Yes, it was an ugly period, but it's done now. We are far better educated as a society. Sometimes things go wrong in a society, and we have had our share of it. But today, we are different people. We have evolved. We have progressed. And therefore, it is about looking to the future, not looking at the past. What do you say?
Well, I say that we haven't evolved as much as we think we have. I think the horrific history and the abuse of Native people, this idea that power and might and superior capacity to do violence entitles you to make claims that are not moral or just, has corrupted our policy making in a range of areas. And you can see evidence of that in the 20th century. And I don't think that we have evolved as much as we claim, because if we had, we'd be making some different choices about how we relate to one another. I think one of the great burdens that was created for all Americans during this era of terrorism and against African Americans is that there was a presumption of dangerousness and guilt that got assigned to all black people. And that presumption of dangerousness and guilt is what allowed segregation to continue into the 1960s and 70s. And it's what, in my judgment, continues to haunt us in our modern administration of criminal justice. I think black and brown boys and children today are presumed dangerous and guilty in ways that leaves them imperiled. People have been protesting in Ferguson, Missouri, and Staten Island, New York, not just because unarmed black men were shot and killed by police officers, but because there is this history of menace and torment and suspicion that has followed people of color their whole lives. And we haven't made progress in overcoming the presumption of guilt and dangerousness because we haven't acknowledged our history and the line that starts during slavery that continues into mass incarceration and excessive punishment. So I think our very future, our hope for racial justice, is inexorably tied to our willingness and ability to deal with this history. We cannot run from it. We cannot hide from it. We're going to have to confront it. And if we're going to develop healthier relations, we're going to have to talk more honestly. And, you know, in the South, what we tend to do is the opposite. We actually have created a counter-narrative where we glorify the South and the Confederacy. If you came to Montgomery a year and a half ago, you'd find a city with 59 monuments and memorials to the Old South. Our two largest public high schools are Jefferson Davis High and Robert E. Lee High. They're 99% African-American. Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday. Jefferson Davis's birthday is a state holiday. We don't have Dr. King Day in Alabama. It's Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day. It's a segregated holiday. And when you look at these indicia of race consciousness, we have not made near the progress that we think we've made, and we are still burdened, injured, menaced, and compromised by an ideology that is often complicated by our lack of honest and sober reflection around racial justice.
But this is not just to be a social movement. This is actually the responsibility, I would argue, of government to rid the country of this mindset, or to help rid the country of this mindset through legislation and through the enforcement of laws. Do you find, or have you looked at the role of the government at both times, when lynching was quite pervasive and today under a so-called progressive administration.
Yeah. No, I think you are absolutely right, and I think that point cannot be overstated. It is the obligation of government to protect the rights of those who are disfavored, who are at risk, who are targeted, who are menaced, who are not in the political majority. And we haven't developed a stronger history or record of that as well. Even during the civil rights era, elected officials did a very poor job of responding to the challenges of persistent segregation and denial of voting rights and mistreatment of African Americans in the South. And that was certainly true during the first half of the 20th century. What's interesting, and we write about this in our report, there was this moment during the first years of Reconstruction when there were federal troops around where there was tremendous black progress. We elected black officials, black legislators, black postmasters, people of color were voting. And then the politics of the North got complicated in ways where the Republicans were no longer willing to continue protecting freed people. And when the troops left, the violence began, and there was an unwillingness to engage in protecting these freely freed people. The United States Supreme Court played a critical role in limiting the federal government's ability to protect formerly enslaved people. So we then have decades where local governments abandoned any pretense of protecting black citizens, and the federal government was largely indifferent. They did not intervene, even though the NAACP and other organizations were making those appeals. In the same way, we see governments today really being fairly complicit with these continuing challenges around racial bias and injustice. The Bureau of Justice now reports that 1 in 3 black male babies is expected to go to jail or prison during his lifetime. In what just society would that not be seen as a crisis, something that government officials would be obligated to disrupt and intervene and manage? And here, it's just no big deal. And that's because we haven't created the kind of consciousness that sees the use of this presumption of dangerousness and guilt to disrupt the lives of so many kids of color as a national challenge, a national priority. And so I do think you're right that government has a central role to play, but we haven't seen much leadership on these issues. And I do think that that reflects in part the failure to develop a narrative that makes that essential to a just society. You go to Germany now, and you see a society that is compelling people to confront the legacy of the Holocaust. You are obligated to see these markers and monuments at the homes of people who were abducted and taken away. The concentration camps have become places where visitors are directed to reflect soberly on the history of the Holocaust. We do the opposite in America. We talk about how great we are. We you know, pound our chests, and we sing these patriotic songs, but we don't acknowledge the ways in which we have failed and the ways in which we must still work to improve our commitment to justice for all.
The great journalist Ida B. Wells Barnett, who began a study, predated you a couple of years, I should say, on lynching and lynch law. She wrote prolifically about this, and it was her cause, and she became well known for that. And she said, and it might have been a bit radical at the time, that the failure of government to intervene therefore teaches a lesson to African Americans, and that lesson, she said, is that a Winchester rifle should have a place of honor in every black home, and it should be used for protection which the law refuses to give. When the white man who is always the aggressor knows he runs a great risk of biting the dust every time his Afro-American victim does, he will have greater respect for Afro-American life. To translate that to application today, what she was saying is that inevitably, when these problems are ignored, people will take matters or would be justified in taking matters into their own hands. Do you believe, based on recent events, the killing of Michael Garner in Staten Island, we had the issue of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and these things are seen as outgrowths of that same process of the stratification of our society. Do you believe that people would at some point get to a discussion again of should these communities, should communities that are seen as oppressed begin to take matters into their own hands?
Well, I don't think that you can violently change the character of a society in any meaningful and sustained way. I don't believe, actually, that you can achieve with a weapon what you cannot achieve with dialogue and engagement and activism and protest. I think the power, the most transformative change in American society on the issues of race was organized, led, sustained, and achieved by people who made a point of not picking up a Winchester rifle, and that was the American Civil Rights Movement. And I think any other effort at changing this country and eliminating Jim Crow and segregation would likely have failed. It would have, I think, legitimated in the minds of some this need for control, this need for domination. And we are a political minority in this country. African Americans are less than 13% of the population. And when you are a political minority and you are burdened with these narratives, these false myths and ideologies that limit the respect, you've got to challenge that head on. And I don't think the challenge is actually advanced very effectively by picking up a weapon. Ida B. Wells was an enormously influential person, and her greatest work wasn't really in calling for arms, but within her meticulous documentation of lynching after lynching. And her legacy is actually a legacy of the pen, not of the gun. It was her careful, crafted, detailed reports that actually brought to light this horrific practice and ultimately got these states to restrict this institution of lynching. Anything else, I think, would have changed the history in a way that was not positive. So, yeah, I get the frustration. I get the anger. But we've got a lot of things that we can do to disrupt the way these policies work. You know, we still have, you know, terribly, tragically low voting rates in communities that are menaced, and we've got to change that. We've not demanded. We've not protested. We've not used our power as human beings with voices to shake and shout and insist on greater justice. And until we do that, we're going to be vulnerable. But it's, in my judgment, kind of a lazy way out, not even a cowardly way out, to pick up a gun and say, well, no, now you've got to do X and Y. I don't think that achieves the kind of justice that most people think it does.
It's interesting that you document most of the lynchings occurring, of course, in the South, and that has been a standard narrative, if you will. But we see also in the North, the so-called progressive and more enlightened North, pogroms against African Americans.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that this was not the number of lynchings were the greatest in the South, but this ultimately became an American problem. I mean, I think the people who fled the South went to communities all across the North and West, and they weren't lynched, but they were nonetheless marginalized and exploited and underemployed and mistreated and abused. And it created decades of generational poverty and isolation, and there were barriers to accumulating wealth and opportunity. And now we see that legacy, which is very destructive and really quite tragic. So I do think it's true that we can't see this as a purely Southern phenomenon. This was an American problem. It implicated every state, every county, every city. And we see the manifestation of that problem in every county, every state, and every city. And until we deal with these issues, in my judgment, more honestly, it's going to remain an American problem.
Well, this is the second report of, you know, such a comprehensive nature that you have produced in 2-3 years, or is it 2 years?
Two years,
the first one on slavery.
Mm-hmm.
What should these reports do? How should people use this report, these reports? What should the reports enable people to do?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Thank you for that. Well, we write the reports to document the history, but we absolutely do not want it to stop with that. We don't see this as kind of just history. We really want to begin a conversation. We want to begin activism and dialogue and change. I think that the visual landscape of America needs to change. I really do think that we take a step forward when we recognize this trauma, when we mark and monumentalize and memorialize the spaces where the slave trade was most active, where lynchings took place. I think that we have been indifferent for too long to the way in which we honor and celebrate the architects of white supremacy and ritualize violence against people of color, and I think we should stop that. And I'm encouraged that on college campuses now, increasingly, there are demands being made that buildings and spaces be renamed if they are honoring things and people who are not honorable. And I think it creates a new way of reflecting on who and where we are. And we're hoping that these reports will be used in a direct way to change the landscape, the visual landscape, but more than that, the moral architecture of the way we relate to our history and plan for our future.
How can people get a copy of this report?
Sure. Well, if you go to our website, eji.org, we are currently making copies of the full report available to anyone who wants one at no cost. We also have other information. We have a racial history calendar we make available to people, which is very popular. Our slavery report and other materials that we've developed on the criminal justice system are also available. We invite people to visit the site regularly for updates and new news, and we welcome partnerships and engagement with anyone who is concerned about these issues and wants to do something.
And finally, Mr. Stevenson, I just want to say this is a way of commending you for doing this kind of work, but what's in it for you?
You know, I've spent my 25 years representing poor people facing the death penalty, people wrongly convicted, people unfairly sentenced, trying to get people out of jails and prisons. I'm an attorney, and I spent most of my career in courts fighting for the condemned and the incarcerated. And I've always felt constrained by the narrowness of the debate and the discussion. I know that race is a huge barrier to fair and just outcomes. I know that poverty is a huge barrier. We have a criminal justice system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. And so for me, the opportunity to talk about these issues more broadly in a context where we're not constrained by the legal restrictions of evidentiary rules and what's admissible is incredibly energizing. I grew up in the South. I started my education in a colored school because the public schools were not open to black children. My hope, my sort of peace quotient requires that I say something about these forces that have condemned and burdened so many for so long. So for me, it's absolutely liberating, energizing, and incredibly exciting to be talking about this history in this way and engaging communities and perhaps turning a corner on a history that has too long condemned too many.
Thank you so much for being with us today and for shedding some light on this particularly nefarious practice in the United States, a history that needs to be known and, more importantly, that should result in society coming to terms with it and moving forward. Thank you so much, Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative based in Montgomery, Alabama. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Jesse Jackson strikes at Little League Baseball.
You refuse to hear my voice. Come tumble.
You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Yatrice Lead. Well, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, having single-handedly, apparently, diversified both Silicon Valley and Hollywood in one fell swoop, has now turned his attention to Little League baseball. Chicago's all-black Jackie Robinson West All-Stars, who cinched the national championship last summer, learned yesterday that they have been stripped of their hard-won title because several players in the championship were not eligible to be on the team. So Jackson calls a news conference yesterday, and he charges racism. The Little League International body, the organization that regulates Little League baseball, is racist, he said, in its decision. And he is prepared to challenge their decision. He says, the kids did nothing wrong, and they deserve to hold on to their championship. But is that really the issue? Of course the kids did nothing wrong. We know that. And I want to talk about this story because, you know, we end up all the time, we have these things happening. Let's be frank about this. Jesse Jackson is a man who is obsessed with attention and will do anything to get it. His buddy, the Reverend Al Sharpton, is kind of sidelined for the moment. He's got his own little problems that he's got to deal with. And so this leaves a vacuum. And nature abhors a vacuum. So Jesse Jackson is more than willing to fill it. And of course, the story is in Chicago, his home base. And so he has reason, he believes, to loom large in this discussion, which is great. I think people need to, you know, when a matter deserves attention, you step up to the plate and you try to do something about it. But here's where my problem with Jesse Jackson is. And it's consistent. You use children. This issue is with these kids. And, you know, they worked so hard. They went to the Nationals and they won. And it was a wonderful moment for the country, actually. And they're called the Jackie Robinson All-Stars. I mean, that's great. All of that harkens back, as we know, to baseball being one of the bastions of racism in this country. And there was a lot of rejoicing when these young kids won the national championship. Great. But the issue isn't them, is it? Nor is the issue race. Well, Jackson insists that it is. But the issue is about crooked adults. Isn't that the issue? It's not about the kids. The kids did their thing. And nobody argues that the children, these young boys, were spectacular. They excelled. But that's not the problem, nor is it race. For Jackson to prevail, to command some kind of attention, he has to subvert the issue. And this is what I have problems with leaders like this. They come and they do these kinds of things, and they get everybody riled up, and now everybody's talking about this is a racial issue. It is not a racial issue. It's about crooked people who are managing this team, doing wrong things, and jeopardizing the hard-won championship that these young children won. That's the issue. Wrong-headed adults, black adults, them, they're the ones. Now, how are you going to stand up in front of the entire country and you're going to talk about race because it suits you, because you and your so-called rainbow coalition, whatever that is, and whoever it's transacting business for, we don't know. But you stage a news conference and you tell people the issue is race. And you tell people because it's the best argument you could make in order to occupy center stage. So you cast it in this mold to give yourself credibility to basically commandeer a presence. You know, we saw that in Ferguson. This is why they were booed, Jackson and Sharpton, literally booed out of Ferguson. People recognize the game that these folks play. Here's what's at issue. There is a rule. People have problems with it. I don't know, but there is a rule. The Little League International, the people who regulate Little League baseball, they have rules. And one of their rules is that members of a team should come from, they have, the teams are assigned to geographic areas from which they can draw their players. It doesn't apply specifically and only to the Jackie Robinson West All-Stars. It applies to all of Little League baseball. If you are a designated team, you have a geographic boundary, and all of your players have to come from within your geographic boundary. That's the rule. Well, it turns out, after investigation, and it seems to be a credible investigation to me, I could be wrong, but it seems like it was credible. Because they looked into this matter not once, but twice. There were allegations, even at the time of the championship, that some of the players really were outside of the geographic boundaries. Therefore, they broke the rule. And therefore, they should not have been eligible to play on the team. Well, obviously this means that the people who are managing the team, they're the ones who broke the rules. The kids are not making the rules. They're managing the team. So if some of their players are outside of the geographic boundaries, they should have known that they were breaking the rules. So an initial investigation was done. And basically, the Little League International said, well, we didn't see anything there. But the complaints came up again. And so, because the first investigation was done not on the spot, they didn't go there. They did it by remote means. They made phone calls, they sent emails, whatever. So it was not as in-depth an investigation. When the charges persisted, they assigned a team to go there and to be on site and to look over the evidence. And what they found was, in fact, that there seemed to be legitimate grounds here to question whether all of the members of the team that won the championship were drawn from the geographic boundaries. It seemed to suggest to them that, or they found, that not all of the team members were from the geographic boundaries. Therefore, the team was in violation. And therefore, They pulled the championship. All right. It's not the best news. It's not great. It's a real punch to the gut. It's not a nice thing to experience, I'm sure. But we're clear. This had nothing to do with the kids. But it did have to do with the adults, who apparently didn't pay attention or didn't care that they were violating the rules and that winning was all that was supposed to be the focus. And now we have, now that the Little League International has made its decision based on the rules, Jackson comes in and charges racism. And now it's now a race issue. And I say, no, it's not a race issue. It's crooked people. Crooked people doing very underhanded things in order to win. And rather than take a leadership position here and say, listen, even that very thing is so, it should be so repugnant. Cheating should be so repugnant to any team bearing the name Jackie Robinson that you would want to honor the integrity of this man. And your role should be to say, well, things were done wrong here. And while we regret this loss, and we regret that they've rescinded the championship title, we recognize that we have a greater obligation to maintain the integrity of this man's name and his history and his legacy. But when you have a chance to step back into the limelight, to feel the warm glow of the television cameras once more, even that is no deterrent. You don't care about Jackie Robinson's integrity, and you don't care about the actions of adults who impugned his reputation by their actions. This is cheating. And the way you should come at this is to say, look, you could explain it any way you want. The people inadvertently did something, or, you know, they didn't know, or the records weren't right, or whatever it is, so that you can make the case that it might have been unintentional, but I don't think that it was unintentional. I think people do. I think people knew where their kids were coming from. And they didn't care. They stepped outside of the code of conduct, you see, that people like Jackie Robinson suffered for. But they have no problem using his name and his integrity and his work and his life's work and his life's dedication. They have no problem just running all over that and adopting this attitude that we can win at any costs. And we throw all of that away. It has no value. And we have a champion civil rights leader standing before the nation, miscasting this whole thing so that he could once more emerge as something of a player, using and abusing the name and integrity of Jackie Robinson, which he himself cannot even begin to match. And he's telling the world that this is racism, and he knows darn well it's about crooked dealings. That's what it is. That's what it is. And the discussion ought to be What kind of leadership are these adults? The children have more integrity than the adults. What kind of leadership are you exerting and exhibiting when you are showing children who are operating at the highest levels of integrity? They did their job. They brought the game home. They super performed. They upheld the integrity of Jackie Robinson, and they upheld the name of their team by their performance, their superlative performance. And it's the rotten adults. And they seek now, through the great interpreter, the great recaster, they seek now to tell the people it's about racism. You see, this is how it goes. And we ought to be real clear. We ought to be real clear about this. And Jesse Jackson is now going to step up and say, well, I'm prepared to sue. What are you going to sue for? You should sue the adults, the managers and the coaches and whoever else found to be in error, found to have run afoul of the law and the rules of the game. Sue them. And we should have a national discussion about the obligations of leaders and leadership. It's a cheap shot. But it is so Jesse Jackson. These are the kind of leaders we have. Here's a wonderful moment to validate these children and the in a spectacular way to say, look, you did your job. You more than did your job. You honored the legacy of this man. You honored the integrity of your team. But we, the adults, we are the ones who let you down. White America didn't do it. We did it. We did it. We let you down. And that's a huge story across the board in this thing we call the civil rights movement and struggle. The people's intentions are very good and pure. The people's intentions are sincere, such as in the protests over Ferguson and over the death of Eric Garner. It's the leaders who come in. The leaders are the ones who are corrupt with their stinking thinking. The ones who shave off points here and negotiate over there and make concessions that you don't see or hear about. Those are the ones. And here we have a vivid example of failed leadership, but arrogant enough to believe that it is entitled now to mess with our minds and tell people this is about racism so that they get that knee-jerk response. And pretty soon, I predict, there will be a protest somewhere, a protest march to embarrass, you know, to shake down the system. Our integrity is down the toilet, but he's going to stand up there and talk like the leader that he is in behalf of children who have, in his view, been done in by racism. No, we're clear. They're done in by corrupt leadership. That's what did them in. That's the inescapable truth. But it is Jesse who has, all by himself and in secret, because we don't know what came out of those diversification meetings, summit meetings that he had with the big wigs of Silicon Valley. We don't know what came out of that. We don't know what came out of his and his good buddy Al Sharpton's diversification summits in Hollywood. But they're busy transacting business in people's name. I keep saying to you folks, they ought to be a public event in which the portfolios of both Sharpton and Jackson are publicly burned. And it's declared that these folks are not our leaders. They don't speak for us. They don't speak for us. But it's so sad. You know, I looked at that and I said, oh, Lord. I mean, kids. I mean, when you reached a point that you could look at your own children and lie to them, I mean, how much lower can you go? How much lower can you really go when you take these wonderful, fresh-faced people and they can't wait to go out there and do a job to the best of their ability, and they brought it home. And they were spectacular. And they raised everybody's sense of pride. And they, more than anything else, they carried on the legacy. We saw Jackie Robinson reborn. All of that is worthy of celebration. And then you have the leaders who did everything possible to contaminate that. And they want to stand up in public now and tell people that they should be championed. They should be protected. They should be advocated for. No, sorry. Sorry. It just does not pass muster. So I thought I would bring that up because, of course, I expect this to be a big issue. It is Black History Month. It's so apropos for these things, which in the scheme of life, they're really pale in comparison to what Jesse Jackson ought to be concerned about right now. But, you know, at some point, the community ought to examine his utility to Black people in America. And there he was. I mean, he was even crying at this news conference yesterday. He was so upset, he said. He was in tears. He cried that wonderful, passionate cry as a man deeply wounded by the injustice of the white system, of white America, just taking its awful revenge on innocent children. Get out of here. Well, that brings us to the end of our program. Stay tuned. Eric Davis and the Expanding Mind is next. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lee. I do like hearing from you, and I try my very best to answer promptly. So thanks so much for being with me today. I hope the program just opened a little window of light to you. A pleasure and a great privilege always to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. It's going to be Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories. Bye-bye. Sisters, when they insist we're just not good enough. We know better. Just look them in the eyes and say, we're gonna do it anyway. We're gonna do it anyway. Something inside so strong, and I know that I can make it. Though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You know that my pride was wrong. Oh no.
something inside so strong.